This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I think Labor will be very keen to be seen to implementing what it told voters it would do. I think they will be very highly attentive to that. But there will be pressure in the Senate and in the lower house for Labor to, you know, be as ambitious as possible in relation to climate and energy policy. Now, how might Labor thread that needle? Well, that'll be the story of the next 3 years, in essence.
Hello, lovely people. You're on Australian Politics and you're with Catherine Murphy, the host and political editor of Guardian Australia. And I'm here today, as usual, as we do once a fortnight, to analyse the latest Guardian Essential Poll data. Unfortunately, my usual co-pilot, Peter Lewis, couldn't join me today to look at the results. Get well soon, Pete, if you're listening. I suspect you will be. But I did talk to Richard Dennis, who is the chief economist at the Australia Institute, and also to John Remington, who's the numbers guy from Essential Media. This is also, this conversation that you're about to listen to is also recorded as a webinar, which is hosted by the progressive think tank, the Australia Institute. The poll information that we're discussing this week covers voter attitudes to the recent minimum wage increase and also to Labor's plans to adopt more ambitious climate change policies over the coming term in Parliament. This conversation was recorded on Tuesday and it was moderated by Ebony Bennett, the Deputy Director of the Australia Institute. And Ebony is about to ask me the first question.
Catherine, I'll start with you. New government, a lot of stuff happening, kind of, I got the sense, a lot of dumpster fires upon opening the doors of the new government. Perhaps we should start with the electricity crisis, but a few fires to put out, shall we say, for the new government.
Sure. Speaking of dumpster fires, yes, the energy crisis, yeah. No, I think that's sort of quite a good way to think about it, Eb. It's sort of like witnessing this at close range. It's sort of been the new Labor administration's come in, you know, opened the doors of the kingdom and then immediately recoiled backwards at sort of, you know, the scope of the task, basically. And, of course, these transitions to government are always hectic, and they are particularly hectic in this instance that the new Labor government has wanted to do a bunch of things really over the first month since taking office. Getting back to the dumpster fire, well, one of the critical ones has been what's happened in the energy market, and that's been a number of different factors that have built up over the best part of the decade, the principal one being that there hasn't been settled policy sort of driving investment decisions in the energy grid over the last 10 years. And various experts in various configurations, both inside the government and outside, have been warning for many, many years now that we're going to hit the wall with this stuff if we can't settle the climate and energy wars. And so Australians got a taste of that over the last few weeks. Obviously, there's international factors that have exacerbated conditions, the war in Ukraine, and there's global supply shortages associated with that, and also with the pandemic still, and gas shortages in the country because a lot of gas is contracted to overseas buyers. And we've got clapped out coal generators spending longer periods offline, so they're not available to generate power. And we had a cold snap, so everybody in the country turned on their heaters. And the national electricity market wobbled in a way that was deeply uncomfortable for Chris Bowen, the new minister, trying to manage that. And there was a significant intervention by the market operator, basically to keep the lights on, to make sure that we could get through this really tricky couple of weeks. So that was pretty heavy duty for a new minister coming in, being sworn in. How do you like this? Thanks very much. And also that new minister is also running at speed because the government, I think, would like to bring in some legislation in the opening week of the 47th Parliament, which is the final week in July, giving effect to its medium-term emissions reduction target, this 43% cut. So all of that's being worked up in the background as well, as is sort of concrete options for how you actually achieve your targets. So that's adjustments to the safeguard mechanism and other things. So, look, these guys, you know, their bums haven't touched a chair really for the best part of 5 weeks as they're kind of running to try and set up as much of this as possible. And that's just only one issue that's happened over the last 4 weeks. You know, Jim Chalmers in Treasury is sort of all of a sudden looking at some expenditure they had a handle on and a lot of expenditure they didn't in terms of the budget and, you know, wants to make an economic statement to Parliament when it opens at the end of the month, sort of bringing Australians up to speed before an October budget. Penny Wong has been pinging around the region, you know, at sort of velocity. Obviously, there's been an outbreak of strategic competition in the region between China and Australia, I guess, in terms of at the diplomatic end of things. And that's sort of the...
But she also had a lot of fences to mend.
Well, exactly.
The place as well.
Exactly. It was the I love you tour. So that's been, yeah, I've now actually lost track of how many overseas trips Penny Wong's done over the last month, and she's currently in Malaysia and Vietnam. So anyway, it's been hectic, Eb. I think that's the way to describe it. I think it's been hectic. Lots of dumpster fires, lots of fire extinguishers.
Occasional landmine.
Smouldering. Anyway, you've got the metaphor.
Yeah. Before we jump into the poll results, Richard, I might come to you. I know you've written a lot about gas in particular, and we're hearing a lot from various commentators, definitely not Catherine Murphy, but that we've got a gas shortage and we just need to, you know, drill for more gas. In particular to help with gas prices. Can you just tell us a little bit about how we got into this situation and whether or not drilling for more gas is actually going to help?
Sure. Look, to be clear, there is no crisis. We're actually going very well according to the gas industry's plan. For more than a decade, this has been the goal, to maximise the profits of the Australian gas industry by selling all of the gas they sell in Australia at much higher world prices, whereas they used to sell it at basically the cost of production here in Australia. So there is no crisis. This was the plan. Some people might not like the consequences of the plan, but it is going according to plan. The plan was so big that it cost $80 billion, $80 billion to build 11 Eiffel Towers worth of steel into refrigerators in Gladstone, to $80 billion, more steel than I think 7 Empire State Buildings got built to create this opportunity for the gas industry. And that was to link up the Australian East Coast gas market to the world market so that they could both sell more gas and they could sell the gas that they used to sell for $3 a gigajoule to us for 10, 20, 30 bucks a gigajoule, whatever they could get. So there's no crisis. We just don't like the plan. And, you know, go back and look at what Martin Ferguson said when he was the minister. Go back and look at what Ian Macfarlane said when he was the resources minister. This was a huge opportunity for Australia, what we're now describing as a crisis. And then, of course, at the same time that we've got these record prices for gas, the thing we're not allowed to say out loud in Australia is that apart from the old creaking coal-fired power stations that Catherine talked about, is that climate change and flooding and record rainfall is the reason that the coal supply has been disrupted, and is a significant factor to the fact that that there's not so much coal-fired generation at the moment. So the expensive gas, well, that was part of the plan. The shortfalls with coal are partly because they're old and need to be phased out quickly, and partly because this is what climate change looks like. We blame climate change and floods for the price of lettuce, but we're not blaming climate change and flood for what's happening in the Australian electricity market right now, which is critical infrastructure was inundated and transport routes were disrupted by record rainfalls and floods.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll get back to this because we've got a few questions in there, I know, about it. But, John, we might go now to the essential poll results. So kicking us off, we are post-election now. What do these results show us about how people feel we're settling into that new...
Yeah, and I think that's it. What we saw, we tracked this before the election, and we do have some longer time periods than what we've shown on here, but... particularly pre and post-election, what we have seen is a shift in mentality from the country. I think going into the election, the lines from the coalition at the time was that Labour aren't ready to govern. They're not qualified or capable. But what we've seen post-election is very much that the issues that are making the new cycle and the position of the Labour government is leading people to think actually we're more along on the right track than on the wrong track as we were beforehand. So a slight increase with the right track, but really it's at 42%. We're not on the wrong track, dropping down to 27, 29. So an umbrella result, which covers all the things that we're going to talk about and that Catherine and Richard have already mentioned, is that on the issues that are coming up and the way the government's dealing with them, generally people are happy with how it's going.
So we'll kick off with international relations. As Catherine mentioned, Penny Wong has definitely been on a please love us tour, come back to us tour. What do we see here in these results?
Yeah, I think this is... We talked here about having a more assertive role, which about two-thirds of people agree with, just under two-thirds, and looking for opportunities for cooperation. Now, what I think we didn't ask here is necessarily having a more aggressive position, which was possibly more along the lines of the previous administration. But certainly, I think what Penny Wong's been doing on her tour as well is asserting the position whilst also building some of those bridges that Catherine mentioned. And generally, that's in line with what people would want and expect of Australia's foreign policy.
Yeah, and you've got a bit of a follow-up question here, I guess, about people's attitudes towards which countries or regions it's important for Australia to have a close relationship with, the USA coming in at the top there, and Pacific nations not far behind.
Yeah, I think that's really quite encouraging for the closest neighbours, but obviously perhaps less economically important, but strategically and at least within the region, 78% of people acknowledging the importance of those relations. The USA, we've asked questions about this relationship before, and obviously not necessarily the major trade partner, but sorry, the most important trade partner, but major trade, cultural, and also military partner, really important to maintain the relations there. We've had more of a deep dive on relationships with China in the past, and again, we see more splits there, particularly to do with age, where younger people see China as more of an opportunity, more of an opportunity for cooperation, whereas older people perhaps are a bit more reserved with the relationship there. Mm-hmm. And we did include Russia and obviously what's happening at the minute. And yes, very frosty relations with Russia at the minute.
Yeah, very understandable results there. Moving on to our electricity and gas crisis, or the gas plan, as Richard described it, you asked people, what's your closest view on the reason for the current electricity and gas crisis? What came out at the top there?
Yeah, I think this is a particularly interesting one. We did see a split across the results, no dominant view. Now, obviously, it's a complex issue. We did conflate the issues of affecting electricity and gas together. And as Richard talked about, there are two quite distinct issues that are affecting them. But overall, there isn't a national narrative which is coming out. What we did see, which is the breakdown on the right, which is quite interesting, is that for Labour vote, or people who said they voted Labour at the last election, they see that as the direct intervention of fossil fuel lobby and Liberal policy. coalition voters or people who voted for the Liberal and National Party the last time, they see it more to do with these unforeseen circumstances, so trying to perhaps deflect responsibility or blame for the previous 10 years of administration. Greens are kind of split all the way down, so they are seeing the neglect and the lack of investment in the infrastructure, but also the policy for the Liberal Party and the minor parties, which now we have to, you know, we should acknowledge include a particularly a lot of those teal independent voters, but also One Nation and UAP. They really see it as that neglect of successive governments. So potentially an opportunity for the Labour government now to try and recorrect the course of those.
Yeah, and I might just take us to this question around the emissions target and we'll jump back out again. But here you've asked what people think the government should do regarding Australia's emissions targets. Take us through these results.
Whenever we ask climate or emissions targets, we immediately see this polarised view of people who have very clear ideas. We have people who are very for creating more ambitious targets, people who are your more traditional climate change denialists on the other side, and they typically, I think, are around 10 to 15%. So overall, yes, people want to see the policies at the election, but there is a sizable minority, a third of people who say that should be more ambitious targets. That is your younger voters and Australians, that is Labour and Greens voters, that is people living in metropolitan areas and people with a higher level of education, so university educated people. So certainly there's a desire amongst those people to see more ambitious targets, but realistically, even within that 49% of keeping to what it took to the election, there will be people who even then think that's too much. And obviously, with what Peter Dutton has announced, his opposition to anything coming in this month, that's who he's appealing to.
Yeah. And just finally, pretty big support for the minimum wage increase here.
This is really good to see. For any long-term people who are watching this, we often see agreement kind of often centering around the middle. So somewhat support having a high percentage than strongly supports, somewhat oppose having a higher percentage than strongly opposes. 44% strongly opposing this. This looks like a home run for Albanese and the government in his first 4 weeks. Huge amount of support higher amongst people who are going to benefit from this. So part-time workers, people working under 35 hours a week, and people who are obviously employed and lower income. So yes, as close as we're probably going to get to unanimous support for something, I think we'll see here.
Yeah, 44% strongly supporting. That's just such a clear backing for this, probably long overdue. I will take us out there. Thanks so much for taking us through those results, John. Catherine, I want to pick up with you on the electricity and gas crisis stuff again, but also that idea around what should happen with Labor's emissions targets. So obviously Peter Dutton is wanting less ambition and the Greens and Independents are pushing for far more ambition. Where do you think things are going to land?
Well, it's just going to be an interesting dynamic in this parliament because the Australian people have returned a more progressive parliament this time, certainly than 2019. You know, you can see this election as a massive correction for the result in 2019, perhaps. But anyway, it's certainly a more progressive parliament. Labor has the numbers to control the House of Representatives in their own right and will obviously need to negotiate with Senate actors in order to get its agenda passed. So I think, you know, if we sort of step back a fraction from the mechanics of the parliament and we look at the election and we look at Labor's pathway to victory in the election. Labor would not have won this year in this election in its own right had it not been able to hold a combination of traditional blue-collar territory coupled with advances in metropolitan inner-city contests. So it wasn't a sort of you know, we were talking during the campaign, weren't we, about Boris Johnson and the Red Wall strategy. It's not like Labor-parted company with its traditional blue-collar working base. It tried to sort of come up with some messages that enabled it to hold its traditional territories and gain in the inner cities, although in Brisbane, obviously, the Greens advanced on Labor in inner-city Brisbane, which was actually quite interesting, fascinating, particularly when you think about the result in 2019. That's a long preamble, which is me saying there will be pressure in this more progressive parliament for Labor to up the level of ambition in terms of targets and so on and so forth. I think Labor will be very reluctant to do that because Labor has spent the last 10 years basically as, you know, in a hostage situation in the climate wars. It's managed in this election campaign to thread that needle that I just spoke about, which is its traditional blue-collar territory with progressive, aspirational people in metropolitan contests. It's sort of, you know, through a combination of policy and messaging, it kind of hit, you know, it created a pathway to 77 seats, which is where they landed. And obviously that's quite a narrow margin. If we were talking about, you know, if this was a normal government scenario where the crossbench hadn't just been radically expanded, we'd all be saying, people like me would all be saying, oh my God, Anthony Albanese controls this on a, you know, there's a hair's breadth between him and oblivion, right? But we now have the Teals, who are effectively a buffer state between Labor and the coalition, which is really quite fascinating and worthy of a whole episode in its own right. But I'm just sort of trying to paint a biggish picture for people here. So I think Labor will be very keen to be seen to implementing what it told voters it would do. I think they will be very highly attentive to that. But there will be pressure in the Senate and in the lower house for Labor to, you know, be as ambitious as possible in relation to climate and energy policy. Now, how might Labor thread that needle? Well, that'll be the story of the next 3 years, in essence. But there are ways and means, I think, of working around that. Obviously, you can legislate a 43% target, and you can also create some accompanying structures and mechanisms around that that makes it clear that you want ambition, right? That 43% is, you know, a floor, not a ceiling. Like that, you know, Labor isn't going to start sort of stopping people reducing emissions in the event that people, you know, double down on their transformation strategies in order to hit net zero emissions by 2050. So I think there's ways and means of trying to step around some of these difficulties. But it will be, look, the opening test of the new parliament will be, in the event Chris Bowen gets his legislation together for his 43% and that lobs in the first week, in the first sitting week in July or shortly thereafter, there will obviously be a vote. Peter Dutton has locked in the coalition to opposing a 43% emissions reduction target, which has greatly annoyed some of his colleagues, despite the fact the moderate wing of the Liberal Party was, well, not wiped out, but certainly had a very substantial blow in the election campaign. What Peter Dutton wants to do for the next 3 years is to take inflation and cost of living pressures and basically staple them to Labor's 43% emissions reduction target and blame any cost increases at all in the economy on that, and hopefully then, you know, come back into Labor's blue-collar territory and start to swap some seats. That's his political strategy. It's as obvious as the nose on his face. In terms of what happens with others, the Greens will have to decide, I guess, you know, how to manage their own position. Adam Bandt will have to make a decision about whether or not the Greens bank the 43, as in support the 43, but make it very clear that the Greens' position validly in terms of the science is for a more ambitious target, or whether we see a vote with the Liberals and the Greens on the same side in one of the chambers in the parliament. But I will be very interested to see how that plays out in terms of an opening sortie in the parliament. Possibly too much information there, but that's...
Richard, I wanted to ask you about the minimum wage decision. And we've really seen an outbreak of basically people blaming wage increases and a potential wage increase or pay rises for potential inflation, and we're warning about the impact that that would have on inflation, which is obviously running much stronger than anyone would want to see. Can you just take us through the actual economics of this moment and how pay increases do or don't fit into that inflation story?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, let's start with the politics. I mean, what do we do in Australia? Victim blame. Like whether it's wages, whether it's unemployment, whether it's blackouts, you know, we just find the vulnerable group and blame them for any big problem. So, of course, here we are with imported inflation. The reason inflation has surged is because world energy prices have risen because of decisions made in Australia. When world energy prices rise, our domestic energy prices rise. Because of COVID and supply chain related problems, particularly with silicon chips and in the building industry, costs have gone up. So we've had, let's be clear, we've had 10 years of low wage growth. 10 years of low wage growth. We've had 10 years of the profit share of GDP rising. And we just saw prices surge 5% in the most recent accounts. So even though we've had 10 years of low wage growth, when prices surge 5%, everyone went, oh, wage price spiral. There's no wage price spiral because prices have surged. And let's be clear, profits have surged because lots of firms are increasing their prices way above increases in costs. So if there's any spiraling going on at the moment, it's a price profit spiral. And then over here, we've got workers whose real wages have just fallen significantly. And of course, everyone's pointing the finger at them and saying, now, if you even try and achieve nominal real wage stability, if you just kind of ask for as much as the rate of inflation, not an increase in real wages, which is what the RBA was targeting only 4 months ago, if you so much as ask for an inflation-linked wage rise, you'll be causing inflation. I mean, it's just nonsense, but it's nonsense spoken by powerful people in defense of powerful interests, which will help further increase the profit share of GDP. So you bet there's going to be a lot of people out there cheering that analysis on. But it's clearly it's clear that wages haven't caused this bout of inflation. There's no evidence at all that if we responded to a one-off shock in energy prices with a one-off increase in wages, that's not a spiral. That's a catch-up. to kind of catastrophize forward is just hiding people's distributional preferences behind some sort of, you know, smug-sounding concern for the economy. But again, we've been blaming the unemployed for macroeconomic policies that cause unemployment for decades. Why wouldn't we blame low-paid workers wanting a wage rise for causing inflation when it's prices that are doing it?
Yeah, I'm sure we'll come back to that in the questions, but I am going to go now to questions from our audience, and I'm going to use my liberties as host to pick a topic that I want to talk about. Mel Smith has said, in light of the Roe v. Wade decision, in the United States, that is the Supreme Court overturning the constitutional right to abortion and termination services in the United States, and what impact will this have in Australia? Catherine, can I throw to you if you've got any responses on that? And Mel particularly wanted to know, do you think it will have an impact on the conservative movement here in Australia?
Hopefully it'll have no impact in Australia, apart from obviously the horror of the erosion of a right in the United States that has been, you know, fought for over generations of, you know, women and allies of women. It is the most extraordinary reversal. And I actually haven't been able to read a lot about it because I find it really distressing because it's, you know, if you understand the history of that debate and how hard-won reproductive rights for women has, you know, as individual entities rather than property owned by husbands or others, you realise just what a setback that is. And yeah, anyway, I find it very distressing. In terms of Australia, well, look, it'll be one of those, you know, I'd call it bobblehead responses where, you know, people will try and make a bit of a culture war out of it. I think at the margins, I think there will be a bit of that. I think we'll probably see a bit of that at the margins. But so far, we haven't seen a lot of it, which is gratifying. You know, even quite conservative politicians, at least people that I've seen over the last couple of days, have been quite measured in the way they've responded to those events. So, look, sensible people in the political system in Australia will not want to open this debate up. But given that there is a lot of, you know, sort of performative posturing at the fringes of part of politics in Australia and elsewhere, I think we'd be naive to expect that, you know, that nobody will talk about this, that nobody will make an issue of this, nobody will try and advance their own profile by getting out and yabbering about this. But, you know, fingers crossed, it'll be at the margins. And also, interestingly, there's been a bit of a discussion since the ruling in the States just about inequities in reproductive services in Australia, which has been quite interesting because it's not a topic that that politics likes to ventilate much in public. Not actually for good reasons, I think. I don't think anyone's shying away from the complexity of the issues, but also I think there has been culturally a reluctance in Australia just to elevate this as another culture war. And sometimes, I know it seems very strange, but sometimes the best way to preserve a right is not to be banging on about it all the time. I think that whole debate, though, about some inequities in the Australian system, particularly for women trying to secure reproductive services, professional termination services in regional areas, for example, has been fascinating to me. I didn't know a lot about that really until I started hearing some of the conversation over the last couple of days. So,
yeah, and distressingly, it often, can turn on whether or not your particular GP backs it or not, which is alarming in itself. But just for people who might not be very au fait with this debate, obviously, it's a direct threat to the health of women, and women will probably die and be injured in birth in greater numbers because of this decision. Around half the states in the United States have trigger laws that will outright ban abortion. And another thing that I think people have been worried about in the United States as well as here is basically just this idea that, yeah, a right that's been settled for 50 years can be overturned. And at least one of those Supreme Court justices has said same-sex marriage and access to contraception is potentially next on the chopping block. So I think a lot to be on the lookout for, essentially, there. But a good point about avoiding the culture war, Catherine.
Look, I guess I just wanted to quickly say, I mean, apart from sharing everyone's horror at what's happening in the US, I think it's important to say in Australia, some of that culture war stuff has already started. I've seen some conservatives saying, luckily, the Australian constitution is based on the British constitution, so these things couldn't happen here, which is odd because there is no British constitution. And indeed, the Australian constitution was largely shaped by our understanding of the US constitution. So that culture war part has already started. And then in terms of access, I think it's really important in Australia. And it's, you know, I think now's a good time to have this debate and push for it. But it's not just people living in regional Australia who miss out. Abortions are very expensive in Australia. And in some communities, the taxpayer relies on faith-based hospitals to provide public care. And Catholic care services, for example, might choose not to offer abortions, which has enormous consequences in some regions. So because we don't rely on our public institutions to provide so many public health services, a whole bunch of things relating to reproductive rights in Australia are actually governed by who happens to have the contract, not just what the rules are.
Yeah. The next question that I've got here is from John Knox. Richard, I might direct this one to you first. Exactly why is the government so loath to strike a super profits tax on gas and coal mines? Yes, I know they said they wouldn't have any new taxes, but is this an extraordinary situation?
Well, it is an extraordinary situation, and it's also an extraordinary opportunity, because if we were to introduce a super profits tax, the government could collect a lot of revenue and it could spend that money, if it wanted to, on actually lowering our cost of living. Like, we've seen how cutting, making childcare free lowers inflation. We know that if we made aged care cheaper or medicines cheaper, we could directly push inflation down. And I think that, unfortunately, in Australia, we have this very old-fashioned, I'd argue, but very narrow sense of economic policy, and inflation's you use interest rates, that's the one lever you use for inflation, and you balance the budget over here. And, you know, actually, we need to be far more creative. And I think a super profits tax is not just a good idea and not just equitable. And, you know, that lefty Boris Johnson even introduced one in the UK, but it would actually allow the government to solve a couple of other problems at the same time. It's also important to point out that one of the few kind of areas for wriggle room that Jim Chalmers left himself pre-election in terms of revenue was multinationals and cracking down on multinational tax evasion. And as some research from the Australian Institute out a week or two ago showed, around 97% of the gas industry in Australia is foreign owned. So I think, you know, unfortunately, I see why Labor went to the election with such kind of narrow guide rails, but the one kind of get out of jail free card they left for themselves was multinational tax evasion. And we've got multinational companies in Australia selling tens of billions of dollars worth of oil and gas, not paying any tax. And if that's not multinational tax evasion, I don't know what is. And a super profits tax, you know, and now, you know, you've got Ken Henry supporting that. So it's taken a while, but we're winning him over, Ed.
The next question I've got is from Alastair McCulloch. Catherine, I might direct this one to you. He's interested in the views on the cuts to the crossbench staffing allowance. His first thought is that without staff who can undertake research for them on policy issues, the crossbench is likely to rely more heavily on interest groups and lobbyists for their research and information, and thereby more likely to be captured by those interests. Do you have any thoughts on that, Catherine?
Well, I think, I think there is a bigger conversation that we ought to have, quite frankly, about resourcing our democracy. Obviously, there's a stink about cutting back staff for independence, and I completely understand and subscribe to the view that independents require in-house expertise in order to assess the complex legislative proposals that come before them over the life of the government. So, you know, I think they should have a decent number of staff. But I think what people in the general community don't always necessarily understand is that the whole system is under-resourced in terms of staffing. This is sort of this zero-sum transaction that's going on at the moment, right? Obviously, the government, one of the dumpster fires, going back to where you started, Eb, that, when Labor arrived, opened the door and went, oh, my God, and shut the door quickly again, one of the dumpster fires, obviously, is expenditure. And getting back to Richard's point, I mean, obviously the budget has a revenue problem, and there's a whole conversation that's going to have to go on about that over this term of government. But just at the micro level, in your parliament, in the place where laws are made, in the people's house, it is my view that we should resource our democracy properly. And one of the reasons we don't is because journalists, write stories about, oh, my God, you know, the Prime Minister's got 40 staff, you know, as if this is a thought crime. I mean, it's not. You know, the Prime Minister is like the chief executive of the country. I mean, it has amazed me for as long as I have been in Canberra how much gets done with how few people in this system. And, of course, we had an inquiry last year about the toxic workplace culture in Parliament House that may in fact speak to that, in terms of staff that are being pushed to work unmanageable hours dealing with unmanageable levels of stress. Perhaps some of the cultural problems that build up around the building may in fact relate to that. I don't know, just speculating. But I just think there's a whole sleeper issue sitting there that doesn't get ventilated, that is about the resourcing of democracy and parliament and political parties more generally. I mean, political parties now are just on this travelator of fundraising. Everybody is, because there's not enough public resourcing of elections and politics. Like, it all matters, this stuff. Representative democracy matters.
Yeah, you don't necessarily want to be running your democracy on the smell of an oily rag. That's a very good point.
Well, that is what happens. Like, it is what happens. And I mean, more doesn't mean better, obviously. You know, everybody in every workplace in the country has got to work very hard. You know, that's what is required. I'm not shrieking about, about hard work. I'm sort of into it myself. But I just think it's like there's a bigger thing here to look at, guys, and I encourage you to look at it.
Catherine's made a really good point there, Richard, but I want to bring the tone down a bit and ask about the politics of this decision. I would have thought that Labor's a little bit shooting itself in the foot here. Isn't it in Labor's interests for the Teal independents to be politically successful in this parliament so they get re-elected and keep the coalition out of government? I would have thought that was an equation Labor might be thinking of when looking at this kind of stuff.
Look, I think there's an element of that in there, but I guess you want to bring the tone down. Let's go all the way to the bottom. Let's assume that they're being brutally pragmatic and thinking, well, okay, all of those Teals will have four electorate staff and one, maybe two advisors. That's a lot more than any Liberals running against them is going to have. So that'll give those existing independents a huge advantage over any Liberal campaign that may or may not emerge in those electorates. They probably don't want to give five staff of Dai Li, who defeated Christina Keneally. They perhaps don't want to give her five staff to make it harder for Labor to win back off her at the next election. But also, I think this is a Prime Minister sending a very loud signal at the beginning of 3 years of power politics that, for anyone that thinks he's beholden to this crossbench, he's make it pretty clear that he doesn't think he is. And, let's be clear, he does have a majority in the lower house, and he will be able to pass legislation whether they vote against it or not. So I agree with most of what Catherine said. I think perhaps we don't realise how few personal staff the ministers in England have. I think people might be a bit surprised to see how other countries' democracies work. But here in Australia, with the systems we've got, with a so-called public service that's so politicised, it would be heresy to say that the public service could meaningfully brief the opposition or the crossbench on how legislation works, because, they're actually a ministerial service, not a public service in Australia. So given all the kind of constraints that independents face, I absolutely think that they need staff to do their job well. But I don't think that this is an accident from Anthony Albanese. I think he's sent a very loud signal about, that he'll be running the show and that he's not beholden to the crossbench. And, will some of that come back to bite him? Perhaps. But, really, I think Labor don't expect to be chasing those Teal seats at the next election. And they're probably thinking Dutton's not going to be chasing them either.
Mm. The next question I've got is from John, who asks, last week the new resources minister, Madeleine King, said the government is seriously considering signing on to the global methane pledge to cut methane emissions by 30% by 2030. Catherine, do you think sign-on is likely?
Well, she said that in an interview with Guardian Australia and, in fact, with me. Sorry to toot my own little horn there, but anyway, she did say that. I was surprised, actually, because I thought, Australia failing to sign the methane pledge was an issue in Glasgow among many issues, which put us as, what does the Prime Minister say, that we've been in the naughty corner, or whatever his preferred description of of international pariah almost. Yes, that's true. Like, Biden made a big thing of it in Glasgow at the UN climate talks last year. more than 100 countries signed on. Australia did not. We didn't sign the methane pledge because the National Farmers Federation is dead against it, absolutely dead against it. Also, the gas industry, because like the methane pledge, basically that, you know, the most affected sectors from Australia signing the methane pledge are agriculture and gas, because it's methane is very potent greenhouse gas that's produced in extractive industries as well as agricultural processes. Again, long preamble. Look, they're clearly looking at it seriously. I don't know whether they'll do it or not. Madeleine King volunteered this. I obviously asked her the question because I remember the debates around the methane pledge when I was in Glasgow last year. I asked her whether or not this was something Labor would look at. She said, yes, we are looking at that actively, but also, you know, just to make sure that no one in the gas industry went, you know, nuts, or anyone in the farm lobby went nuts. She said, we'll also embark on a very serious consultation, or we're in the process of consulting with affected sectors. So, yeah, look, it's a bit too soon, I think, to say whether or not they'll do it, but they are certainly actively looking at it. And in part because, to Eb's point about, and my point earlier about the Please Like Me Tour of Pacific and other areas, the new government, the new Labor government, is using climate policy, its more ambitious climate policy, as a point of entry into a number of relationships at this point in time. Also, the world is relieved. Anybody who understands, you know, what's happened in climate policy in Australia in the last 12 months is absolutely dead set relieved to see, an election cycle like the one we've just had embolden the government to have some ambition. Tanya Plibersek, the new Environment Minister, you know, got a very rousing welcome at the Oceans Conference in Portugal yesterday. The world is genuinely very glad to see Australia back at the climate change table in terms of international negotiations. So a bit too soon to say whether they'll do it, but again, they are certainly looking at it.
Yeah. Richard, anything to add to that on gas and methane?
Well, look, I hope they do make that commitment. But let's be clear, liquefied natural gas is liquefied methane. Australia is the largest exporter of liquefied methane in the world. And the reason we want to open up the Beetaloo Basin, the reason we want to open up Scarborough, is because we want to extract a lot more methane. So you bet the gas industry will fight tooth and nail to protect their right to massively increase methane emissions. Great that the government's even holding that open. But to be clear, liquefied natural gas is liquefied methane. And this is what we're being told we need to drill more of to solve our energy crisis. Brackets, not a crisis, it's a plan. So, yeah, I think there's a pretty big mixed signal there. I'll focus on the optimistic bit and say, great, we're going to make a pledge. But when we drill for methane, a lot of it leaks out, called fugitive emissions. And of course, the whole point of drilling for it is so that someone else can burn it. So, you know, at some point we have to admit there's a complete disconnect between saying reducing our domestic fossil fuel use with a 43% target means tackling climate change when we want to double our gas exports.
Thanks so much for listening. That's all for today. Thank you for tuning in regularly, as you do, for the podcast edition of Poll Position, which is the webinar hosted by the Australia Institute. Bear in mind, just a reminder, you can look at the slides for the essential poll results, and you can pull them up during the conversation. You can access them on the Essential Media website. This episode was produced by Daniel Simo, and Miles Martignoni is the show's EP.
Namaskaram, my name is Mayad. I'm a tour leader with Explore. Come, follow me for a breakfast you will never forget. Namaste. Because you are going to make an incredible masala dosa under the watchful eye of my mom.
Kya baat hai, mom?
Each home adds their special touches. But not everyone gets to join in a traditional family meal. You will if you explore.
For global adventures, search exploreworldwide.com. And don't just travel, explore.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.